You are listening to a special news report by the News Collective. You might call us Democracy Watch, or we're not sure. This is a special broadcast. But this is some local news by the News Collective. My name is Alex DeBoer. We're broadcasting today from the unceded traditional and ancestral territories of the Coast Salish Musqueam people. It is 6:05, and I don't have a script in front of me.
I'm Isla Yu.
I'm Armand Rana.
And on today's Democracy Watch Arts Edition, we bring you coverage of the Vancouver chandelier, the Ethno Vancouver overdose alert poster, and the anniversary of the Laco Polytechnique massacre.
But first, a couple of headlines or a headline. So the staff at the City of Vancouver recently approved an 8% budget. They proposing an 8% budget increase. And everybody's freaking out about it. Well, people who have a lot of property in Vancouver are freaking out about it. And some of the reporting has focused on the new mainly climate kind of initiatives approved by this council. But according to the staff presentation, 4% of this 8% increase is coming from fixed costs and 2% from risks identified by the staff and only 2% from new initiatives proposed by council. And I was reading this interesting piece by Alex Hemingway, who's a PhD candidate here, I believe, at UBC on Policy Note, entitled Property Tax in Vancouver Are Still Too Low, Fueling Inequality and Speculation, where he talks about how Vancouver actually has the lowest property taxes in North America because people keep cutting it because the property prices go up and they cut the taxes. So.
Yeah, that's a pretty contentious opinion.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. Because one of the things to keep in mind, though, as well, on the other side, is that though Vancouver might have very high property taxes, incomes here are really low. But it'll be interesting to hear his perspective. I'm hoping to interview him next week.
Yeah, that'll be good. Yeah, he's been featured on a number of news interviews. He's from the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. I've talked to him a couple other times. That's a very interesting opinion, and it'll be good to talk to him about it. It's interesting because Vancouver has always been an expensive place, but traditionally property taxes have actually always been lower in Vancouver and the Lower Mainland than compared to other major Canadian cities. But it does seem to be hiking up a lot in recent years, in all the municipalities. But it's interesting to compare Vancouver's proposed, I'm sure it won't end up being 8.2%. Yeah. It'll probably end up being 5%. But compared to Surrey, I think they just passed, it was 2.something%. Yeah. So it is a lot higher. That'll be cool if you talk to him. Isa, you had a report or a headline on L'École Polytechnique.
Yeah. So today, December 6th, marks the 30th anniversary of the L'École Polytechnique massacre. A gunman murdered 14 women and injured 13 others before killing himself. A ceremony was held on Montreal's Mount Royal Friday evening, and 14 beams of light were shown into the dark sky to honor each of the victims. Present at the ceremony were survivors, the victims' families, dignitaries, and the public, notably Trudeau, the Quebec Premier François Legault.
Yep.
Okay. Governor General Julie Payette and Montreal Mayor Valérie Plante were there.
Getting a phone call?
Oops.
A news alert?
At the ceremony, Trudeau also mentioned that he would vow to reinforce gun control by banning military-style assault weapons during his speech at the ceremony. And the city also unveiled a new sign on Thursday to recognize that this attack was rooted in misogyny and it was anti-feminist.
Yeah, it's interesting. I heard an interview this morning on The Current, CBC's The Current, with one of the women who survived that attack 30 years ago. And when the person who separated the group into men and women and then decided to shoot all the women, was about to shoot them, he said, "I'm shooting you because you're feminist." And she said, "We're not feminists, we're just students." And so The Current had a really interesting conversation I would encourage people to check out about, you know, the use of that term and like what it meant to that woman at the time and what it meant to her later. Yeah, I find that word really fascinating because like there's definitely a generational divide over what it means, and like the connotation of it has changed over the years so much. Like 30 years ago, it had a much stronger like activist and militant kind of connotation to it. But yeah, anyway, that was an interesting thing I heard this morning. Mm-hmm. So worth checking out.
Yeah, and also on like the topic of Trudeau mentioning he wanted to reinforce gun control, the thing about Canada is that even though theoretically firearm laws are officially controlled by the federal government, which ideally would have created like the same kind of restrictions across the board, we have the constitution and it allows for the provincial governments to opt out. So it's not really standardized. Yeah.
So basically Trudeau can't blanket.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd have to pass it, but he can't implement gun control federally. It has to be accepted by each province and territory. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
So, yeah. And then another newsworthy thing.
Oh, this is a DIY headline.
Yeah.
Or, yeah. Because we were, not to jump in, but a sort of focus of today we wanted to have was on local art, because I did a piece on the chandelier, the West Bank's spinning chandelier piece done by Rodney Graham. And so also some folks around the station were talking about a art situation by an artist named Fno Vancouver. We're not allowed to say the F word on air at this time of the night, but it's the real word. And then, yeah, sorry, Isa, I'll let you take it from here.
Right. So, Fno Vancouver is a Vancouver meme account on Instagram that recently received backlash for one of its posters made in collaboration with the Unit Pit. The offending poster was a parody of an overdose alert poster, and it said, "Drug checking this week found high concentration of pumpkin spice. Do not use alone. Go to a gentrifying espresso bar. Avoid mixing with peppermint, mocha, or chai. If you are in a group, don't forget a camera for selfies. And carry
naloxone.
And yeah, so many commenters on the post, which was on Instagram, felt like it was done in poor taste and trivializing the issue of drug abuse. In response, Unit Pit issued a statement that can be found on their Instagram, and it says that the poster was not displayed in the downtown east side, but in neighborhoods that these kind of overdose posters are rarely found. It was, you know, to spark conversation. It was apparently created in consultation with quote unquote frontline workers and drug users, but I don't know what that would really specifically entail. Like, I don't know how many people they really consulted.
Totally good point.
And the content was intentionally dark and offensive for the purpose of like interrogating people's lack of discomfort to gentrification itself that results in further marginalization of drug users. So the poster was a part of Tear It Down 2019, an ephemeral group art exhibition on poster kiosks.
Right, they put up posters on. Yeah.
And so the artists were asked to create works in response to Vancouver's unaffordability and housing precarity.
Right, yeah.
Right, so thoughts?
Yeah. Did you have a chance to look into this, Armand?
I heard about it from Isa a little bit when she described it to me earlier. I didn't see it myself.
Yeah, so like I can see how it was meant to be like a satirical piece, but at the same time it does seem kind of tone deaf, especially because like the opioid crisis is such like a big deal in Vancouver. Yeah, that's my take on it. You?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of ironic when, like, groups like Unit Pit or, like, whatever art group that's located in the downtown east side doesn't see themselves as gentrifiers in any capacity. Like, everyone can look at a Starbucks and say, well, that's not culture. You know, no one is going to mistake that. But when you have like nonprofit organizations that are still run by people who are really privileged, like really like socially affluent, people of middle class backgrounds, like people like myself, like probably all of us in this room, it's easy to like overlook the fact that we are still the first wave of gentrification. And like, I'm not saying it's bad to have an art space in that area necessarily, but just like to have no acknowledgement of like your own gentrification. Yeah, I think it's like, I don't know. I get it. I think I have a problem with like some of the works by that meme artist. They posted one, like Armand, I don't know if you remember this, but it was like on the day of the UBCM, which is the Union of British Columbia Municipalities Conference, which you and I attended. Yeah. And it was at that convention center, Waterfront Convention Center. And like this meme account, FNO Vancouver, posted about how all the trucks had intentionally driven like through the middle of the downtown east side on check day to like disrupt everyone in the downtown east side with it. Because it was all these logging trucks came down to the convention center because all the municipal and like a lot of provincial politicians were there having a conference. And for those who don't know, like the logging industry was and is in like a huge catastrophe. Basically like a ton of people had lost their jobs and like mills were closing down. So the loggers came down to protest. And like this person was just like, whoever runs FNO Vancouver was like so offensive that like all these trucks came through the downtown east side on check day, like no respect for like the community, blah, blah, blah. And it was just like, you obviously have no understanding of urban labor issues.
And where these trucks are coming from.
Yeah, you don't understand where these trucks are coming from. You don't understand that like that is the street you use to most easily get to the convention center. Additionally, so it was like made in like defense of like poor people and drug users in the downtown east side, who, by the way, pretty sure they're not checking their Instagram accounts to like to be like, yeah, like heck yeah, like it's like it's all about social capital, you know. So that's what I think about that. I think there's a lot of social capital happening and not a lot of self-analysis and like self-educating.
Yeah. One thing I found interesting, I haven't seen the poster myself, but just listening to your description, is I think you could interpret that poster in a different way, that meme in a different way, in the sense, if you are someone who likes pumpkin spice lattes a lot, mm-hmm. you would not necessarily interpret it as, oh, I'm a cause of gentrification, but maybe like, oh, look at me. Like, even if I'm addicted to something, it's something so harmless and benign as pumpkin spice latte, and I'm such a wonderful human being because I'm so, I don't know, you know what I mean?
Like, I don't really know what you mean.
Actually, I do. Yeah. Like, this is kind of the problem a lot of commenters on like Instagram had. They felt like it was like trivializing and using this language that is associated with like legit drug use and kind of like applying it to pumpkin spice lattes kind of, it's just like dismissive, and it's like making.
Oh, you mean like the whole like, yeah, this thing's so good it's like on crack or something?
Yeah,
like that kind of like expression. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like elevating. It could be interpreted as elevating pumpkin spice latte for people who are actually fans of pumpkin spice
lattes,
instead of the opposite.
Yeah, I see. Interesting. Very interesting. Well, should we go to the chandelier? Do we have anything else to talk about?
Yeah, I think we should. We should go to the chandelier. Like Sia.
And what?
Like Sia.
Like Sia?
Sia has a song called Chandelier.
Oh.
Now that you've explained the joke.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that. Okay. This is an interview that I did. I think it was on Monday. This week has really gone by quickly. I think it was on Monday with Eric Fredrickson, who is the manager of public art at the City of Vancouver. I was interested in asking him about the Spinning Chandelier, which is a piece of art that was built by West Bank, which is a development, like a luxury development company in the City of Vancouver, owned by Ian Gillespie, and the artist was Rodney Graham, who's like a renowned, a very, very prominent Vancouver artist. And it's received a lot of backlash and some praise. So I won't give any more context because it's all in this piece. And sorry if anyone is listening. The intro is meant to be for Seeking Office because I'm going to put it on that feed after. So you'll hear some of that. And that is what happens when I don't have time to edit things properly. Anyway, enjoy this piece and we'll talk about it after. Hello, dear Seeking Office listeners. This is Alex DeBoer. I'm not really making this podcast anymore because I don't get paid to make it, and so I can't keep doing it because I need to work on other projects that pay me. But I love local news, and sometimes I might throw up an interview or a piece on this feed. Who knows? Anyway, today I interviewed Eric Fredrickson.
I'm the head of public art in cultural services at the City of Vancouver.
You may have heard of the Spinning Chandelier, which is a new public art installation located under the Granville Street Bridge. It was funded by West Bank, a luxury condo developer. And it's been getting a lot of media attention.
The chandelier officially unveiled Wednesday night. It's designed by world-renowned local artist Rodney Graham.
Beautiful, beautiful piece. We're excited to be here this evening.
The fixture is complete with LED lights.
So as you can hear, some people think this chandelier is beautiful. Others have described it as Versailles-like, tone-deaf, pretty, f***ing ugly. Really, there's a lot of perspectives out there, and I am not here to tell you what is art. You can decide for yourself. What I find most interesting about this public artwork isn't whether or not it's successful as art, but the questions it raises about public art more broadly, such as how are public art projects approved, and what kind of public consultation is involved. We know with the Spinning Chandelier, West Bank commissioned this $4.8 million public art project as part of its Vancouver House, which is a 52-story residential tower. So I assumed West Bank was required to build a piece of public art as part of a community amenity contribution for the rezoning that took place in order to build the Vancouver House.
It's not technically a community amenity contribution.
That's Eric Fredrickson again.
So those are negotiated between the city and developers, and those could be in kind if they're delivering a daycare center or a school or a park.
So public art is a separate thing. It's not part of CACs or community development contributions. Instead, Eric says, it's a set formula that's applied to large-scale redevelopments.
If you're building over 100,000 square feet in a rezoning, and it's not non-market housing, social housing is exempted, but all other uses are not. And that's just a set amount. It's currently $1.98 a square foot of public art.
Okay.
Worth of public art.
Okay, thanks. These private development-funded art projects are one of the two major ways public art is created in Vancouver. The other way is probably in line with how you would assume public art is created, which is when the city itself commissions public art, which reflects civic priorities. But actually, when I asked Eric for the numbers on how much public art is created by developers versus how much public art is commissioned by the city, I was surprised at what I heard.
Yeah, I can't give you real useful numbers on that. It's hard to track in any sort of disciplined way because the time frames are so long. Like in the case of Spinning Chandelier, the obligation was incurred back in, I think, 2014, and the project is delivered in 2019. I'd say there's more work. There's clearly more work that happens through private development than happens through the civic program.
Okay, interesting. To reiterate, there's more public art commissioned through private developers than by the city itself. So what does that mean? If private developers are commissioning all this public art in our city, what mechanisms are in place to ensure that the art is appropriate or tasteful or liked by the people of Vancouver? I learned from the city's website that developers who are required to build public art have a few boxes to tick.
When a developer is bringing a project for rezoning, they will hire an art consultant. The consultant will write a plan, and the plan is typically reviewed by the Public Art Committee.
The Public Art Committee. This is the group that developers and their consultants send their public art plans to for review. So it's at least one mechanism of accountability. I asked Eric to tell me more about the committee. So you said it's appointed by council. Like, who's on it? How are the people appointed?
There's an application process. It actually just closed for the terms that will start at the end of the year. So the committee is something that was established by bylaw in 1991, I believe, and it has a fairly...
Eric tells me that the Public Art Committee is made up of two artists of recognized standing in the art community, three art professionals, two urban designers, one developer, and one member of the general public. Now, it's important to note that the Public Art Committee doesn't vet the artist or the art project put forward by a developer. They just review the planning that's involved in making that artwork happen. So essentially, the committee doesn't have very much power over what art is getting made. And that leaves me to wonder, what meaningful input do either the city's elected officials or the public have on developer-commissioned public art projects? I asked how this worked in the case of the spinning chandelier.
So that's really, like, public art committee is meant to be direct oversight of how projects are being planned rather than, you know, community consultation.
Right.
Because they make recommendations directly to council.
Yeah, I understand. So council appoints the members of the public art committee. But then in terms of public consultation, how did that work? Was there direct public consultation, or was it just the public art committee reviewing the plans?
Yeah, more that. I'm not sure what level of consultation happened and whether it was part of the development generally.
So Eric wasn't around when the chandelier project began 4 or 5 years ago, but there likely wasn't any direct public consultation. He said that sometimes in areas of the city that have a strong cultural community, or an area that is actively developing its sense of identity, the city will ask for input from the public, though they aren't required to.
There's no sort of structured, this is how consultation and how engagement should work on public art projects.
Right, and with this one in particular, the city didn't recommend working with a specific nation or anything. They didn't highlight any specific needs of that neighborhood that needed to be addressed, like
not
in terms of which artist were, yeah.
Yeah, this was in 2014,
yeah, it was
most
a bit
likely,
before
so
your time.
I'm not, yeah.
Okay, and then the Public Art Committee, so you said it's appointed by council. So to recap, we now know that more public art in Vancouver is commissioned by developers as a requirement in large scale rezoning projects than by the city itself. And oversight largely comes down to a public art committee, which is appointed by council. But even this committee only has power over the art project planning, not who the artist is or what the artwork is. And with that in mind, we return to the spinning chandelier. So for the spinning chandelier, there's been quite a few different opinions on it. The mayor is quoted describing the chandelier as the most important piece of public art in the history of our city, while a headline from Vice predicts it'll start a class war. So I'm wondering, why do you think this piece of art is so divisive?
I think when you're doing a project that is scaled physically at the size and has the budget that it has and is in the form of a massive chandelier, it wasn't a surprise to us that it generated really strong responses. It's something that, you know, has been underway for years and years, obviously, mm-hmm. and then it lands at the time that it lands. And it's not to say that 5 years ago, a lot of the concerns that people have in the city weren't also present. But they are at a particular level currently, and, you know, this steps into. And so I think that we were expecting that there would be a lot of response to the work, and that the response would be, you know, there would be a lot of different sort of responses, including really strong responses about the nature of the work and its budget and its location.
Right. You mean, yeah. Like, in light of, you know, the housing crisis and the opioid crisis and stuff?
Right. Yeah, and I think it's something that will happen with public art generally. I think there's huge value in taking the work of artists and having it be in the public realm, not just reserving it for commercial galleries or for museums. But it will always create tensions around cost, basically.
A lot of people think the $5 million put towards this public art project is too much. But Eric says the cost of public art is always contentious. And you can usually make the argument that the money put into public art could be better used towards another public good.
If I said, I recommend let's shut down the public art program for a year or for 5 years, there isn't something that says, oh, that amount of money was money that the developer just broadly owed to the city and that we can then take and use for whatever we want. That was something that developers agreed with, something that benefited the city, but also benefited themselves in a way, because, you know, it adds value to the neighborhood that their projects are in as well. So again, it's not that you can see it as a levy that we could just decide tomorrow that money is going to buy things other than public art.
Right, but the city could change that.
I don't think they could unilaterally, is what I'm trying to say. It's not something that that we just could say, now you need to pay us $1.98 a square foot and we're going to spend it on
libraries
or housing.
Eric brings up the dependent relationship the city has with developers. How the city can't just tell developers what to do, because not only do we rely on them to build housing in Vancouver, we rely on developers to help build new schools, new parks, childcare centers, a variety of amenities, all through community amenity contributions. But I guess, like, the concern I have is that, as you said, there's more public art created by developers than by the city itself. And with, like, such a limited public consultation, I find it troubling that we have developers, like these for-profit companies, sort of creating culture in our city. Do you find that troubling at all?
I see what you're saying, certainly. I think that negotiation is sort of built into the way the city has been operating, and it's something that I think people are interested in taking a look at, whether rezonings are the only way to work to add, you know, housing or to add space to the city, whether there's other ways.
It's important to note, Eric says, that rezonings, which are the reason developers are required to commission public art, those rezonings do go to a public hearing. So people can speak to council directly about that rezoning project, but they won't really have any say in any required public artwork that the developer commissions. And this is kind of just the way things work in Vancouver. Like housing and amenities, developers have a lot of control over public art and subsequently over culture. Thank you very much for speaking with me, Eric.
You're welcome. Thanks for your questions.
Thank you for listening. This piece was made by me, Alex DeBoer. The music you heard was Entwined Oddity and Thoroughput by Blue Dot Sessions. This audio was recorded and produced on the unceded traditional and ancestral territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. All right, and we're back. If you just tuned in, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is a special news report. My name's Alex DeBoer. Who are you guys?
I'm Isla Yu.
I'm Armand.
Cool.
And you just heard a piece about the recent chandelier episode where I think it's West Bank is installing this public art.
Yeah, it's been installed.
Yeah.
Yeah, underneath the Granville Street
Bridge. That costs like $5 million.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah. And it's generating a lot of controversy.
Yeah.
And Alex looked into, like, what is the approval process and consulting process the city kind of takes.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I'll just, like, bring up maybe some stuff that I couldn't really fit in the piece that I thought was interesting, such as that it wasn't in the piece, but I brought up that, you know, a number of artists have pointed out that development, like obviously luxury developments or even developments that have market rate rental are still completely unaffordable to many people in the city and many like working artists and poorer people. Like, and so when you have these developers building these expensive places to live and then also they're building this art, they're actually pushing out a lot of the artists themselves from the city that they live in. A lot of the best art in cities comes from like poorer areas and poorer communities, and like, and then I mean it's like the waves of gentrification, right? It's like there are like poorer people in an area, and then like artists and like young like intellectuals, like the kind of
cool people.
Yeah, whatever. Like, well. But this is like, these are the waves of gentrification. Yeah. They come into a space and then the richer people see like, oh, cool, this space is like, they kind of like clean it up a bit, yeah, or whatever. And then higher class people see that, come in and like build more expensive stuff, gentrify, whatever. So like, these are the waves of gentrification. And so there's a bit of irony there in that this art is making the city unlivable for a lot of artists that are the reason developers even go into the neighborhoods they do today to build art and to build condos or rental. So that was interesting. So I brought that up to Eric Fredrickson, and he sort of said like, yeah, one thing to take note of is that this spinning chandelier is only one of many projects, public art project the city of Vancouver has been part of, either projects that developers commission or that they commission themselves that fit with like their civic priorities. And so there are lots of other projects that are doing that are much smaller scale and that involve like community. He brought up a couple, like one where an artist is working with like senior citizens, or like one where another artist is working with like school kids. And like there's a lot of other projects he pointed out that are like much smaller scale and much more DIY. So it's important to take note of those. But and he said this is the project that's gotten the most media attention out of all the public artworks he's dealt with over like the past 3 years, I think, which is because it's the most expensive.
Yeah.
And another thing to note, which was maybe not totally obvious in that piece, is that the reason it's so expensive too is because this public art project is actually the combination of three required public art projects by West Bank. So they got rezonings for three different buildings. And because they were large scale rezonings, they were required to put X amount of money into public art. And so instead of building three separate art projects, they built one.
They just lumped it into one big thing.
They lumped it into one. Yeah, exactly. And so most public art projects just would never have a budget this big. But because this is a combination one, it did. And yeah, so that is something that is important to note. But I think the main point here is like, and what I was trying to look into, what I was curious about and led me to talk to Eric, is just that is just to answer the question of, like, how is public art in the city made? Like, how does it come to be in Vancouver? And like I said in the piece, there's basically two avenues. There's it's commissioned by the city itself. They commission an artist, and it, like, fits with whatever, like, whatever work is going on, whatever, like, larger project. Or they build public art through developers who are required to build it through rezoning. So, and then, like, the process that I got into specifically with developer commissioned public art, and, like, you know, the me asking him about what kind of public consultation is involved. And I think that was interesting to me. I don't know. Do you guys have, I'm like talking a lot. I'm so tired. What, someone else say something.
Yeah. So I think one of the things about this whole chandelier fiasco, and I messaged this to you when I first read the story, was that, like, $5 million is a lot of money. Like,
yeah.
You could employ, like, a lot of artists, like 5-6 artists at a pretty high salary for like 10 years. Plus materials, on a full-time basis, doing public art with that kind of money. So I think it really speaks to the need for the city to maybe use its leverage if it wants to commit to this model of developers doing the public art. They should at least use their leverage to make the developer do it in a more community-oriented way and engage the community, and also even in terms of economic terms, distribute the money in a sustainable kind of long-term and equitable way instead of just, like, giving, I think, a single artist, like, $5 million for... Because, you know, at a certain point, art becomes, like a investment, you know, asset that, like, you know, rich people use to, like...
Absolutely.
To, like, trade with each other and to avoid paying taxes.
Of course.
And I don't know necessarily if the city wants to incentivize... you know, developers, you know, going in that direction with the type of art they're trying to purchase instead of, like,
I mean, yeah. So, like, and then as we heard in the piece, I did ask him about, you know, couldn't this money be better used for something else? And of course, it's like, you can say that about any public art project. And also, like, the city has to, this is the whole point, right? Like, the city has to work with developers to, like, find a way that they both benefit. So it's really both of them working together. It's not the city saying, I need you to do this. So they worked out this deal with developers because it benefits them and it benefits the city. But it benefits developers a lot because they get to build a piece of art that increases, you know, maybe, like, the value of the area, or builds, like, culture, brings tourism to an area near, usually quite near to where they've built a new building that they've got rezoning approval for. So, yeah. So could the city work out a deal with developers where instead of building these public art projects, they instead invest money into, like, artist programs, like, or to have... Yeah, pay an artist for, like, a year, or a few artists for a whole year.
For many years.
For many years,
For $5 million.
Yeah, like, that seems, I mean, and but then some people might say, you know, I'd rather have public art.
But it could pay these artists to do public art on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Instead of, you know, and you could have a grant every year for 10 years for a different artist, you know, to do public art once a year.
And I think public art is generally pretty expensive, though, because you need to have materials that will last a long time, right? Like, unless you're doing murals, I guess.
Yeah.
Murals aside. But if you're putting up, like, a statue, any sort of statue-like art piece, right?
I don't think the cost of materials... Like, I would like to look into it. I would wonder what the breakdown is between the cost of materials and the cost of the art.
Right, good point.
Itself.
I think
I highly doubt that the cost of materials, I think it's probably less than 10%.
Ooh.
I would imagine, because it's not real crystals. They're all fake crystals.
Yeah, I know, that's true. They're plastic, right?
Yeah, they're all plastic crystals.
Yeah, so that's a really good point.
So I don't know if it would cost like $1 million to make a plastic chandelier.
Yeah.
Even if it's custom made.
Yeah, totally. But then there's like the rate, like you can raise and lower it and it like spins. I don't know, maybe ongoing maintenance is factored into... I don't know.
Yeah, it'd be good to look into that.
Has anyone seen the chandelier IRL?
Mm-mm. No, I've seen pictures. I haven't seen it in real life.
I haven't seen it. I was going to say I memed my face in front of it for an Instagram story.
Oh, you cut yourself out?
Yeah, it was really great. It was really funny. I don't know. Any other thoughts on the chandelier?
Not particularly.
I think that I will put this story up on the Spinning Chandelier on the Seeking Office newsfeed. You can find it on Stitcher, iTunes, or Google Play, or on our website at CITR.ca if you just search Seeking Office. So please look for that, and I'll post about it on social media. Other than that, thank you very much for listening, if anyone's listening. And next Thursday, there will be another News Collective show, which is called Democracy Watch currently. Yeah. And Armand's going to hopefully talk with Alex Hemingway from the CCPA, Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Yeah. About the city budget. Anything else you guys want to say?
Yeah, no, that's about it. I look forward, to next week's show. And, it'll be interesting to kind of understand. Also, even when you're talking about the, property taxes.
Yeah.
And we're talking about how the city's, expanding its resources and leverage. It's also a question about how redistributive are property taxes in the sense, they do tax generally rich people, but is that money going to actually redistributing, finding its way back to people lower down on the income scale, or is it being used to pay different consultants different amounts of money for, evaluating art projects or whatnot?
Really good point. Yeah, that's a good point. I hope we can answer those questions. Well, thank you to everyone who's listening. We have actually a special live broadcast coming on in about 9 minutes from 8 East Studios. It is a live broadcast curated by Gunarji O'Sullivan, I believe is her last name. And it is, she's put together a series of audio documentaries created by residential school survivors, and there's also live music. So it's a really wonderful community event. It's free to attend. So if you're in that area, it's in Strathcona, East Van, 8 East, just Google it. You should check it out. If not, just tune in here and you'll hear the live broadcast from 7 to 10 p.m. So that's coming up next. Thanks for listening. This is CATR 101.9 FM. Have a great night.